So again, welcome. I'm Marie, and I've been a student of Lama Jinpa's for, actually, this is my 10-year anniversary this year. So anything I say today is really anything that he's said to me. And my personal understanding of it at this point in my path. So things that I get wrong, that's all on me. That's just my misunderstandings. And just so you know, if you hear me talk again 5 years from now, or if we talk 2 months from now, things might have changed, because things are changing all the time. Our understandings are changing all the time. So this is all just kind of based on my understanding at this moment in time. So, and some of you may know me. I lead the Tonglen meditation group on the third Friday evenings of the month. And Tonglen is known as sending and receiving, or giving and taking meditation, where basically we're exchanging the suffering of others for our compassion and loving kindness, and taking in their pain and suffering and confusion, and extending our wisdom, compassion, and loving kindness. And it is an incredible, powerful practice. I can just tell you, just based on my personal experiences, that it is definitely something that if you really practice diligently and regularly, you will see changes take place in your mind and in your practice and in the way you deal with the rest of the world. Plus, it's a really nice group of people. You should swing by some Friday evening. So Tonglen, the meditation practice, Tonglen means sending and receiving, and it's actually comes from a practice called the Lojong practice. There are a series of what are called Lojong slogans. Lojong means mind training in Tibetan, and it's often called the seven-point mind training. A teacher many, many centuries ago named Geshe Chekwa Yeshe Dorje actually kind of collected together a much longer work by his teacher, Atisha, and kind of boiled it down into 59 kind of really pithy slogans that it's really nice. You can pick up a Lojong slogan, read it, and, you know, meditate on it, and then, like, even do a little further reading on it, get a deeper understanding. And it's something that it's really good to kind of continue to revisit over the years. Because, again, as you can see, your mind changing and your understanding's changing. So, actually, in the back, there is a booklet of the Lojong slogans that you're more than welcome to pick up and bring home with you. And there are tons and tons of books out as well on Lojong. Susan's done Lojong practice for many years. She could probably recommend some great stuff, too. So, the Lojong, again, is set up with these 59 slogans, and it's split into seven parts and in seven points of mind training. And the first point of the mind training, it's all really common sense, by the way. It says, you know, practice the preliminaries, the bases for Dharma practice. And whenever you hear people talking about the preliminaries, they're really talking about keeping in mind what we call the four reminders, the four thoughts that turns your mind toward the Dharma, which are things like, you know, remembering that this human life is really precious. It doesn't come around every single time, and that your life is going to end, and you don't know when. Could be next week, could be 20 years from now, could be, you know, could die of a stroke 5 minutes from now. We just don't know. So, and recalling that karma is always a factor. Whatever you're doing, bad or good, there's always karma attached to that. So you have to keep that in mind. And also to keep in mind that as long as you are too caught up in your sense of self, your own self-importance, your own solidity, thinking whether you're good or bad or anything like that, worrying about what you want what you don't want, what makes you happy, what makes you unhappy. All of those things are obstacles that get in the way of the real goal, which is awakening. And those four thoughts are really the things that kind of inspire us and motivate us to do Dharma practice, right? Time is short. We've only got this one shot. And the wonderful thing is that, you know, the Buddha teaches that we really can't awaken in this very lifetime. So that's kind of like the very stepping off point of this Lojong 7-point mind training. It's wonderful because it's both very practical, and then over time, as your understanding refines, it becomes very subtle and powerful as well. So those are the preliminaries. What I really wanted to talk about today is really the second section of the Lojong slogans. And point two is the main practice, which is training in bodhicitta. And bodhicitta is a Sanskrit term that really means the spirit of awakening, where you are generating a completely enlightened mind, a mind that's completely aware, balanced, calm, and not being, you know, tugged back and forth by things. It's really kind of a, you'll hear it called our innate Buddha nature, so complete clarity. So we're trying to generate bodhicitta, this perfect awareness. And there are actually two kinds of bodhicitta. And doing Tonglen practice is actually the central part of one of those kinds of bodhicitta, relative bodhicitta. Kind of, in a way, what I think of is kind of, it's like almost like everyday, practical, basic bodhicitta. Tonglen practice, again, is sending and receiving, right, where we're taking in the suffering of others and we're extending them all of the good things that we have. And it's a really wonderful practice to do. And it feels great because you're being nice, you know, doing nice things for nice people, maybe doing nice things for some not-so-nice people, which can also feel very nice and virtuous, right? Being such an awesome Buddhist, doing Tonglen for this mean person. But if you've been coming to Lions for any roar for any length of time, you often hear Lama saying, it's not enough just to be nice. That isn't the whole point here. While it is important, that isn't the goal. The goal isn't to just be a nicer person, right? The goal is awakening. And the goal of Tonglen isn't just being nice and making other people feel better and just reducing harm. The point of Tonglen is transformation. Transformation of your mind, transformation of your thoughts, transformation of your attitudes and your view, especially in particular on yourself and your own sense of self-importance and uniqueness, what we call self-cherishing, that feeling that I am very solid and real and have edges and I'm separate from other stuff. There's me and there's you and there's the people I like and the people I don't like and the people I don't even think about. That's what we're trying to get away from. And the point of Tonglen is to open us up and to lead us away from that sort of a very narrow mind. Tonglen is a Mahayana practice. It is a very high-level practice. There's lots and lots of books about it and lots of places that do it, so I think sometimes people think, oh, you know, this is pretty easy. But really, if you're keeping in mind the real goal and the real purpose and the real view, it becomes very powerful and over time becomes very, very subtle. Well, I trust it will become very, very subtle. I'm not quite there yet, but working on it. So, again, there's two types of bodhicitta that we're generating in these practices, absolute and relative. And it's funny because, you know, we think of relative states as being like the lower states, right? And absolute states as being the higher states. But really, when you read through the Lojong slogans, they talk about absolute bodhicitta first. And I was thinking this morning, it's like, well, you know, why do they do that? And I think the reason is that you have to understand the mind state you are going for in order to not get wrapped up in a more relative mind state that maybe feels good and a little less esoteric and maybe a little more clear to us where we are right now. So there's five slogans in the section on absolute bodhicitta. And slogan two says, regard all dharmas as dreams. And dharmas can just mean phenomena, things, stuff. So we're regarding all dharmas as dreams. All phenomena are dreams. And this is really important because we have to understand that things that we see around us, me talking, the chair you're sitting on, this chair that's in front of me, it all seems really, really solid. But everything is changing from second to second, even shorter than second to second, moment to moment. Everything's really changing, right? It's all in flux. It seems really solid, and it seems like it has edges, but everything's really rising and falling. Every moment that I'm talking becomes a moment that moves into the past, right? So all that's really existing is this present moment. And everything else, everything I'm thinking about, I need to talk about this in a few minutes, or anything that I just said, falls away. And it's really like a memory or a dream, right? We call stuff in the past memories, stuff we're thinking of for the future, dreams. So all that's really happening is this tiny thing, like right now, right now. And that's the case even with stuff like this, right? Because, I mean, like even on the most relative level, this table is being like bombarded by cosmic rays. And they're having these minute effects on the table, right? And then we also know that eventually it's going to fall apart. Happening right now, just on levels we can't see with our really ordinary minds. But we know. We know we can observe that in a very gross way that things are always changing. So we know that this is true, right? So none of this is solid. So it really isn't something that's actually happening, right? It's happening, but it isn't happening. It's happening in a really relative way, but in the end, it has no solidity, so it isn't something that's permanent and lasts. So we're regarding all dharmas as dreams. And this is important because, again, that helps us not become stuck to these ideas of ourselves and of situations we're in or, you know, people that we know. The next slogan, slogan three, says, examine the nature of unborn awareness, which you could probably spend like a lifetime just studying about unborn awareness as well. But at this point, where you can spend a lifetime talking about like every detail of all of this. But really, here what we're kind of talking about is just like a really, you know, we're starting with a really basic mind, right? So what we're looking for is like that really basic mind, like looking at, well, when did my mind begin? When did I begin, right? Can you look back and see that moment where you began, where your mind stream, what you identify as you, began? And as you kind of break it down, you can't find it, right? There's like not really a beginning. So there's just nothing there to hold on to. So it loses its solidity. Kind of like a dream, right? So the thoughts that rise and fall, they're just little dreams that are coming up and floating away. So it's a, you're thinking about the nature of a kind of mind that isn't rising and falling, just is there and is steady. And recognizing that the mind we have right now isn't that one, unfortunately. The next slogan four, is self-liberate, even the antidote. And the antidote here that we're talking about, the antidote is always realizing that our thoughts have no origin, that everything, our thoughts, and of course all these phenomena, our perceptions, our ideas, the way we see and hear and smell things, really don't exist themselves, right? They're all dreams that are always changing. And so they don't really have an origin of their own. So they aren't standalone things. They're just like all phenomena. They're impermanent. And they don't have any substance. So you're not going to hang on to them, right? So you're not going to hang on to desire. You're not going to hang on to hatred. You're not going to hang on to confusion. Those are things that you want to allow to fall away. And that's what these practices do over time, is you're examining those thoughts and realizing, okay, that has no real substance of its own. You know, I'm angry at this person. I have to go grocery shopping. I wish everything would in my life would be better. All of those things. You have to allow them to just realize that they don't have substance, and again, they're dreams, and they will fall away. So, yes. Please, yeah, please. We're going to make you.
Yeah, thank you, Doug. I mean, really, honestly, it's great that you do that. Because otherwise, none of this blah, blah would get. So, okay. The antidote, from my understanding, is the view of emptiness. That's the antidote to desire, hatred, and ignorance. That's the end of the three poisons. But to self-liberate even the antidote, the problem, I think what that's trying to address, if I remember correctly, is you can get caught up in nihilism. The antidote of emptiness, you can get caught in that and go, oh, well, it's all empty, so what the hell? You know, exactly. And so you need to self-liberate even that.
Exactly.
Even that, even emptiness is empty. Even the unborn awareness is.
Even your understanding.
Yeah. So it's to not get caught up in nihilism,
right.
is kind of the point, if I remember correctly, of that particular slogan.
Thank you, because I totally the nihilism. Thank you. That's a part that I didn't like. Click into. So again, that's really important, you guys, because you can't, if you just stop with, okay, everything's just empty and that's it, and there's nothing else, that is nihilism, because otherwise, if that's it, if that's the ending point, there is no point. The other part of it also is that self-liberating the antidote is at this point, just because you get that point, that, you know, everything's empty, you know, we all have our level right now where we get that, that doesn't mean you're done practicing. That isn't the end, right? That is just the point where you have to really start beginning to kind of drill down and refine your view. So you've had a small amount of realization, and actually that's kind of where the real work begins. That's where the climb begins to become steeper, because you're starting to generate these more and more subtle levels of understanding and more subtle and refined mind states. So yeah, that's not the point where you're done. Slogan 5 says, rest in the nature of Alaya. the essence, which is sometimes defined as the present moment. It's also defined of as sort of a home or a base, or you could think like a home base, a basis, a home. And actually, when you see the word Himalaya, Alaya, so that's right, land of snows, home of snows. So it says rest in the nature of Alaya, and this is really basically, it's the resting place. It really is. It's the home, and it's a place where you have kind of, in a way, stepped past the regular consciousnesses, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, all of those, and then the mind that kind of coordinates them, and the mind that kind of generates all of your discursive thoughts. And kind of after that is this home base that's stable and balanced and understanding. And in a way, Susan, would you say it's almost kind of like a state of equanimity? It's kind of just really, it's balanced and just kind of, you're able to just like see phenomena rising and falling, but you're not grabbing onto it. You're not taking sides. You're just observing. And it's just awareness. And it's a very, very calm state. And it feels good and balanced. But again, it's not the complete goal. Equanimity isn't the goal. And we're not cultivating this. It's something that's just there. It's a state that's there. One time Lama said to me, equanimity doesn't choose, right? Equanimity is just something that is. Equanimity doesn't say, it's like space. Space doesn't say I'm close to Susan and I'm far away from Marie. It just is there, right? So that's what this is. This is a home where we're just able to be there and rest in a really calm, open, relaxed state. So we're not, siloing everything around us and saying, this is me, this is not me, this is good, this is bad. We're kind of using it as a stepping stone to a much more subtle and refined state of mind, which is a completely awakened mind. Makes sense so far? So this is still a relative state. Question? How is it different from the sutra? Similar concepts, some of the similar concepts. I mean, of course, the Heart Sutra touches on emptiness and stuff, but this is really more of kind of a practical practice, more step-by-step. So they relate to one another because they are addressing similar concepts, the same concepts and ideas, but they're just kind of different approaches. Right. The sutra was the words of, the Buddha, and then the shastra is like a commentary or a writing by another teacher. So. Okay. Right, presented a little bit differently, and yes. No, it's not a commentary on the Heart Sutra. Again, it's a kind of a condensation of Atisha's work, "A Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment." Thank you, you guys. I appreciate it. So again, it's a relative state. This still isn't like an ultimate state. It's really refined, super, super refined, but still, depends on other phenomena to come into existence. So this it isn't the same as complete awakening. So still not the ending point. Slogan six goes even further and says, you know, in post-meditation, be a child of illusion. And I really love that phrase, child of illusion. And in a way, it's kind of like Chogyam Trungpa said once that it's kind of like you're putting your meditation into action, because at this point, you're stepping off the cushion, right? You've been sitting, you've been meditating, you've been thinking about, you know, entering this state of alaya, you've been thinking about how things, you know, don't have inherent existence. So now you're ready to get up off the cushion and go out into your everyday life and go grocery shopping and to work and all of that stuff. And he says, that's really what this is talking about, is that you're bringing the understanding that even though you're doing all of this stuff, it's really an illusion. And you're bringing the question, who is doing all of this stuff, to whatever it is that's going on? So into these really like super relative things you're doing, like driving and you know, hanging out with your kids or friends or whatever, you're also kind of keeping in mind the view that these phenomena aren't solid and that they aren't permanent, and that you are that it really is all a dream, that none of the phenomena are solid, none of the things, none of the people, none of the stuff that's happening are solid. So really, in a way, you're in a dream all the time. And it's really cool, because a lot of times we think of our meditation practices like what we're doing when we're sitting on the cushion in front of the altar. A really great metaphor I read is it's like taking a light bulb from a lamp in your room and putting in a flashlight so you can carry it with you. So you always have this light to shine on your own thoughts and things that happen, where it's always going to kind of flash on and remind you. So it's always, you know, flashing on and off. And I really loved that metaphor, because I can see that in my own life. As, you know, you're driving down the street and a thought comes up and you'll be like, oh, well, you know, that's this kind of a thought, or, you know, that doesn't have any basis in reality. So, yeah.
I find it really comforting sometimes when things feel so solid and kind of visceral, to think about it being dreamlike. And what I'm challenged by is there's this term in psychology, dissociation, which is where you're kind of dissociated from your awareness in this way that's pathological. It's like you're just detached and numb, right? And mm-hmm. So I think that's the real challenge. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that, is to regard phenomena as dreamlike and yet still be fully present and not, you know, oh, I don't have to worry about any of this stuff, because it's kind of falling into that nihilism almost, right?
Well, and I think that's where you really have to you know, keep in mind that, you know, there's Lama says there's like two tracks, right? There's relative and ultimate. And we have to kind of hit that spot in the middle. So, yes, this is all a dream. But also, at the same time, and it truly is a dream, empty of any real existence on its own. But at the same time, people are hungry. People are bleeding. There is a solid world, and that's one of the things about our school of Buddhism, is where we grapple with, you know, there's this relative physical world that we exist in. You know, we have to acknowledge it, otherwise, you know, we're not going to be able to do things like drive like sane people. So you have to kind of have that balance where, yeah, there is a world that I have to acknowledge and work within and do stuff within. I have to feed myself. I have to earn a paycheck, because that's just the way things are set up. And at the same time, realize that you can't become wrapped up. You can't become stuck to it. And that when we don't keep those both those views in our minds simultaneously, that's when we really slip deep into samsara and into our own suffering. And that's when we become, really start wallowing in ignorance. So it really is something where I think that's the other part of this slogan, is that remembering that this cultivating this view can't just stay on your cushion. You have to be doing it all the time. So you're not necessarily doing formal meditation all the time, but being willing to constantly remind yourself and go, you know, I know, it's like, I know that feels really solid. That idea, that thought, that belief, that feeling feels really solid. But the willingness to examine that, like, even in the moment, you know, and or to at least say, I need to think about this, take it to the cushion. But there, I found, at least for me, there's become kind of an almost constant process where there's like this checking in going on, like the flashlight keeps flashing on and off, on and off. Does that make any sense?
Lama likes to quote something that Padmasambhava said, and which relates directly to that, which is, my view is as high as the sky, but my actions are as fine as barley flour. And that's pretty much, I think, that's encompasses the entire apparent dichotomy, which is also illusory. I think that a lot of the antidote, the thing that we need to really antidote the most is our own concept of whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Anything that I think is true, it's not true. The moment I conceptualize it, I'm wrong.
And we're really
trying. I don't need concept to get there, but if I move into the concept and reify the concept,
exactly. What we're trying to do is avoid solidifying things. And that's the whole idea behind having to understand ultimate bodhicitta before we go into the relative practices. Because if we don't understand this part, when we start the relative practice of Tonglen, if we don't understand that these phenomena don't have inherent existence, that what we're doing is Tonglen practice within, is all just really a dream. If we don't have that kind of foundation first, when we start doing Tonglen, it's going to get really sticky. And we're going to start being really attached to the doing Tonglen for the people we love, or how we feel, or, you know, what mind is doing it. So the whole point in the Lojong slogans of going over ultimate bodhicitta first is to avoid just that stickiness and that kind of getting caught up that we were talking about just now.
So, and for me, it's really easy for me to read the various Nisendri Lojong texts and go, oh, yeah, I get it, yeah. And, like, but, like, this is, like, a constant struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Understanding these, working with these. I mean, there's another 50 some odd slogans that are all just as
pithy as
practical
these are. Yep.
And to the point and completely, really, really super practical stuff. After all of this really ethereal slogans on bodhicitta, but when I read that, you know, you got to get this first. It isn't like I get it.
No, it isn't like you actually get it.
Right, yeah. It's like, oh, yeah, I got it for like a third of a second. And then I worked on it.
And then the flashlight clicked off.
Right. So it's not like you stop. You don't work with the other 50-some-odd slogans, because those first six or seven are just like, what the hell is a child of illusion? So I can't go any further. You don't do that.
No.
You just go, okay, I got it a little bitty, bitty bit. And then you keep working. And then, you know, like you were saying, you come back 6 months later and you got a little bit more.
Right.
And so it's like that. So when we say things like, you know, so once you get that, you know, yeah. Take that with a grain of salt.
Because especially when I'm saying that, I definitely don't mean that I get that. And that's what I was saying at the beginning. It's like, this is my understanding where I'm at right now. And the wonderful thing is that, you know, we have our brothers and sisters to kind of, you know, pitch in and kind of help with their understanding. And that way we'll all get to the same place at the same time. So, yeah, so... No. I mean, you guys, this is stuff that, and that's the wonderful thing about it, is that it's just constantly progressing and it's portable. Really, that's what this particular slogan is, that you don't need to solidify the phenomenon, because even off of the cushion, you can begin to kind of develop this kind of ongoing awareness and kind of almost like an ongoing practice. Practice isn't just when you're sitting down. It's, you know, while you're bumbling around at the grocery store or whatever. So it's there, too. Lama talks about Dharma in everyday life, and that's what he's talking about. And that's really, for me, I found that's where a lot of the transformation kind of comes from, is being able to kind of apply it in the moment in like a practical way, and then go, oh, what mind did that? It was maybe a mind that didn't grab onto something as hard as it did before. And so you see these progressions going on, and you get a chance to examine stuff as it's rising and falling.
Just the way that I understand the whole see things like a dream and stuff like that. It's a metaphor, the way I see it, you know. And also the other like we recite every day, like a star, like a mirage, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Like it's not like everything is a star, you know. Like it's the way I understand that is it's a metaphor, because if we take it super literally, then we sort of, I think, like we misunderstand what it's saying, like. If we take it literally that everything is a dream, then that means that there's somebody else dreaming everything, and that, you know, when we wake up, we'll be someone else. Like, but the fact that it's a dream, the important part for me is that things are not solid, that things are constantly changing, and at any moment they could shift. And that's the important part, not that it's not real and that it doesn't matter and stuff like that. So, yeah, like those little things, it's like a dream. So it's more of a simile. And it's more like a way you're supposed to experience things, but maybe if we take it like super literally, as like it is a dream, then, you know, that can kind of mess you up, you know, but.
Yeah, and there are teachers do address that it's like, you know, you aren't just wandering around in this fuzzy world where nothing's real and you just kind of get to float around and have no edges and stuff. It's like, you still have to perform bodhisattva activities, and you still have to do stuff. Yeah, there's still karma. I mean, stuff is still rising and falling. You are still doing stuff. So again, it's that middle spot where you're understanding that things aren't solid, but also developing the skill to function. So, you know, you have the wisdom mind part, right? And then it's like where your view is so refined, but then your actions are as fine as barley flour, where your actual activities and your skillfulness is also very refined. So refined view, refined skill. You're saying? Well, and then the other thing we also, makes it really confusing, is that we also have to understand that we can't get too wrapped up in what our definitions of illusory and dream and all of that are. So, yeah, but, and you know, something that just came into my mind is like, so people may be thinking, well, why is it even important to acknowledge that, you know, that things don't have solid edges, that things are a dream. And again, it's because we make things so solid and so real. And some of the danger of that is that we then start categorizing stuff and it creates barriers. Again, we start categorizing the people that I like, the people I don't like, the people I don't think anything about. And that's a real flaw in our view. We start separating ourselves from things and phenomenon. And the idea behind Tonglen is to allow us to understand more our own permeability and the permeability of everything else, so that we aren't constantly siloing things into these solid definitions and categories, because again, those create barriers between beings, and it creates a barrier in our mind between ourselves and awakening. So, thanks, Susan.
I don't want to get you too far off track, so, you know, if this gets you off track, just, you know, forget about it. But I wonder if you could address the other aspect of Tonglen, which is the destruction of the self-cherishing piece.
Exactly. So, yeah, perfect. That actually brings us to Tonglen. Yeah. So, and perfect segue. So, we talked about ultimate bodhicitta, which you can see is like, you could spend, like, forever, lifetimes, just meditating on ultimate bodhicitta. And then we get to relative bodhicitta, which is the Tonglen practice, really. Slogan 7 says, sending and taking should be practiced alternately, sending and taking. And these two should ride on the breath. And really, it's talking about the Tonglen practice itself, where you are inhaling the suffering others and exhaling your loving kindness and compassion. And really, that's where we get into the transformative part. And that's kind of earlier I had said where a lot of times people get caught up in Tonglen because it's a nice practice. It makes them feel a lot nice, that they're nice people doing nice things, doing something nice for other people. And that's wonderful. But it isn't the point of Tonglen. And in the Tonglen group that I lead, I actually teach two types of Tonglen. And there's one that's kind of almost like a more Western and psychological approach that's been more popularized, more widely popularized, that may be familiar to folks who've read maybe some of Pema Chodron's books, where you're inhaling people's suffering and confusion kind of as a dark charcoal gray smoke, and you exhale your compassion as a golden mist. And so there's just kind of this exchange that's taking place. And it's a wonderful, beautiful practice, but kind of more focused on, like, harm reduction, right? Just kind of making things a little, you know, a little bit better. Lama also taught me another form of Tonglen that he kind of calls tough Tonglen. And it's a much more Vajrayana style of Tonglen. And really, this is the one that, for me, is really kind of where the transformation takes place, where you're really seeing how the change takes place in your mind. And what happens in that one is we all understand, you know, as we've talked about, karma follows us always. Karma follows us from previous lifetimes. We all have karma attached to us. And many of the teachings talk about our dark karma as kind of being as a coal at our very centers, right? And in this tough Tonglen, what you're doing is you're visualizing that suffering of others or another person coming at you, and it's like a black iron arrow. And it just comes in and it strikes that coal, that core at your heart, that dark coal, and just crushes it. So basically all of the suffering of all of these other beings is coming straight at you, and it's hitting all of your suffering and confusion and all of your innate ignorance and the three poisons, and it's crushing it. And when you crush a coal, what happens is it transforms into a diamond, right? Diamonds are just compressed coal. And then in this Tonglen practice, you just take that diamond and you offer it back. And that diamond is everything. All of your good karma, all of your bodhicitta, all of your wealth, your health, all of the merit that you've created, absolutely everything that you have, that you could imagine you might have one day, you offer it to others. And that's the transformative part, where you are crushing those wrong views. You're crushing that attachment, that desire, that anger, the aversion. Pardon? Yeah, and you're self-cherishing. Because what you're going to find is, as you're doing these meditations, your own thoughts are going to come up, and there are things you're going to have to deal with in Tonglen. That actually, I think, in a way, is what's been so transformative for me. Was at first I was stopping, you know, I was doing Tonglen, and I would be thinking, I'll just use an example. I have a dear friend who is actually dying from fourth stage lung cancer, and it's been tough, because at first I'm like doing Tonglen for Dennis, and it's like I just, you know, want his suffering to be reduced. I want him to be calm as things are going on. I want him to feel better. I want him to... But what I noticed was in the background, it would be, I want Dennis to feel better. And it would be like, because I don't like to see him suffering like this. Because it makes me feel uncomfortable. Because it reminds me of my own mortality. Because it reminds me of my own pain. Because it makes me feel guilty. And it's all about I. And in the end, everything ends up being about that. So the value of this process in many ways is, yes, you are, of course, cultivating compassion for others, and that's critical, absolutely critical. But at the same time, you're examining the things that come along with that. And as you're seeing them, you're applying the antidote, realizing that that is a self-cherishing mind. That's a mind that is feeling how solid it is, and applying that understanding that, again, that's a dream. And all of that stuff that mind is turning toward is a dream. And all that stuff that mind is hanging on to is a dream. Is that kind of what you were thinking of?
I'm not very experienced at Tonglen at all. So, I mean, from the limited amount that I know of the practice that I've done with it, when that black smoke or the arrow or whatever it is that I'm envisioning comes in and strikes my heart and the coal in my heart, that is my self-cherishing. And what shatters, I don't see it yet, what shatters for me is my self-cherishing.
Right.
And it's just, it's a practice that, they say, you know, when you do Tonglen, you do it first for yourself.
Mm-hmm. They do. And then actually the actual slogan 10 is, begin the sequence of sending and taking with yourself. And I can't emphasize how important that is. One, from a relative standpoint, the person we're generally the hardest on is ourselves. The person we generally have the least compassion for, the least patience for, the person we're usually angriest at is ourselves. We say things to ourselves we would never say out loud to another human being. So from a relative standpoint, it's just really important to do that. But again, from that ultimate standpoint, we have to be willing to engage in that process of crushing that self-cherishing and of really seeing that it is not the kind of view that we need, and seeing that we need to change it, and that we don't exist firmly, strongly, inherently, and that what and when we're doing that Tonglen visualization, I kind of think of as there's that like that moment where the, you know, you're in a way your own ignorance is coming in and striking your own ignorance, and crushing your own ignorance, and it's that moment where you're recognizing that this is my own ignorance, that this is my ignorance doing these things. That's the transformational moment where the diamond kind of, okay, crushed it. It became that diamond of wisdom. And when you're offering it out, another really important thing Lama taught me is that when you are offering, you know, extending back that diamond to everybody, your own compassion, all of that, he says, remember, all of that's also coming back to you from yourself and from other practitioners. So it's not just back and forth. It's like this whole cycle. It's a constant cycle. But yeah, it's really, really important that recognizing that there's that moment where you're saying you're willing. And it takes a willingness to say, yes, this is an ignorant thought. This is self-cherishing. Willingness, honesty to say it, and then go ahead and just say, and then crush it. Yes, sir.
Well, it also strikes me how non-dual the teaching is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, especially already you're talking about self and other as being non-dual.
Mm-hmm.
And then even when you're taking with your metaphor of coal and diamond,
mm-hmm.
there's no difference.
Right. There's no difference. There is no. It's like the water in a teacup and the water in the river. The water is still water, right? So awesome. Thank you, guys. Awesome questions and comments and. Wait, do you guys want to take a little break and come back and do a short meditation? Or do you want to just do, let's see, it's almost 10 after. Do you want to just do a short meditation and closing prayers and then, okay. Oh, thank you, guys.